Welcome back. Live from our KGGF studios here in downtown Coffeyville. Sam Speck back with the K-State Research and Extension agents, Barbara Ames and Jacob Weber. Barbara, Jacob, welcome back.
Thank you.
Talking a little bit about flood water and, you know, what to do with your food after that flood. You can listen back to that with our podcast on the main screen of our website underneath the community tab at kggfradio.com. But you guys have got some other things within the food safety science as well, and the Serve Safe Food Handlers training coming up in the month of June.
That's right. On June the 12th, we're going to be doing a Serve Safe Food Handler training. It's going to be at the Southeast Area Research and Extension Center there in Parsons, there at the corner of Ness Road and 400. That's going to be 9:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. It's a three-hour class. And it uses materials from the National Restaurant Association. It promotes food quality and helps participants understand and control foodborne illness risk factors. We're going to be talking about things like food safety hazards, how to provide safe food, how to receive and store food, preparing, cooking, serving. Personal hygiene is a big part of it. And then purchasing, and we talk a lot about cleaning and sanitizing. So, to register for that or for more information, you can contact K-State Research and Extension Wildcat District Independence Office at 620-331-2690. Or you can email me at bames@ksu.edu.
Yeah, I think, first of all, proper personal hygiene and then cleaning and sanitizing is something that's overlooked. Like, say, a cutting board, for example. You're cutting up a raw meat and then you use it for vegetables and then you use it. I mean, it's just, it could be a mess sometimes, literally a mess with that. So there's some things that you overlook. And then, of course, when I was working in the kitchen, they had me this technique for the how done a steak was, you know, or how done the meat was due to how much pressure that you could apply to it. But in reality, it's not going to do the same as the thermostat does. So
right. You want to use that thermometer. And you want to, if you can, separate those cutting boards, too.
I caught it.
I figured somebody would. Cool. Registration, and it's due next week, it looks like.
Registration is due by June the 5th. That's right. There's class spaces.
I hope you were the only one. All right. So Serve Safe, always good to kind of, even if you think you know everything, always good to kind of loop around. And then also, you know, is there an age limit or anything like that? But it's great for, you know, younger.
No age limit at all. It's really good for people that work in food handling, like school service or long-term care facilities. But it's also great for people who maybe just help with church dinners.
That's true.
And things like that. So if you're handling food at all, even in your own kitchen, some people just come because they want to learn more about food safety and so it's for everybody.
Absolutely.
And we just urge you to get registered and come to the class on June the 12th.
Well, and then I remember this from last year as well, but your guys' kind of installment of Dining with Diabetes kicks back off. Looks like somewhat of the end of the summer there, but good to prepare for it.
Right. It begins Thursday, August the 1st. And actually, this is a program. We know that nutrition and physical activities are keys to managing type 2 diabetes. And so this program does really get into the food part of that. It's designed for people with type 2 diabetes, and we're going to learn skills needed to promote good health. We're talking about planning meals and snacks and cooking demonstrations with food sampling is kind of one of the big parts of it. And then helping motivate and support by connection with other people. I know a lot of times people develop a relationship there, some camaraderie, and that's a big part of it for some people.
It is.
And just understanding how diabetes affects your overall health.
Yeah, the camaraderie and all support is such a huge thing. You see it with cancer support groups. You see it with diabetes support groups. Sometimes
right.
It does take not only bouncing ideas off of another individual, but also just relating with them. Sometimes
right.
You may be the only one impacted in your family or your surrounding friends, and being able to relate with someone, I'm sure, is very beneficial.
I remember last summer when one lady came. She'd been newly diagnosed with diabetes, and she was very, very just upset and depressed and without hope almost. And some of the others said, you know, you can do this, and here's how we've managed that. And she came back the next time and said that was just so helpful and just changed her life. Just, you know, having some help and can't think of the word I want here, just
support.
Support.
You know, outwardly support, yeah.
Encouragement. That's what I was looking for. Encouragement from some of the other people that had already been through that. So this is a series of four classes. They're going to be Thursdays in August, the 1st, the 8th, the 15th, and the 22nd. It's 5:30 to 7:30. And it's going to be also in Parsons at Labette Health. We are partnering with Labette Health to do this class. So it's going to be in the Rector Center there at the Labette Health location in Parsons. Registration is $25. It covers the cost of the food, and they will be getting food each time. And that's required by Thursday, July the 25th.
Awesome. And then I know last year you didn't. It looks like it is coming back again. But you guys loop back around with the same group and kind of check in a couple months later, right?
Right. Then about 3 months out, we try to do a reunion class where people can come back and we study something a little bit different. But again, just get together and encourage one another.
And I'm sure within those 4 weeks of August, you know, they're going to add a couple of names to their contact list, get some friends, and again, bounce some ideas off, but more really
and
just
get some
support.
Good recipes and cooking techniques and just learn how to count carbs and manage that very serious disease.
Absolutely. So some great courses. Tell me a little bit about this National Festival of Breads here real quick.
Right. Well, that's kind of sponsored by the Kansas Wheat Commission and also King Arthur Flour and Red Star. It is the National Festival of Breads, a bread baking championship. So,
and you're going to be there.
I'm going to be there.
Awesome.
I am. I'm going to be kind of helping in the background a little bit there. It's June the 8th at the Hilton Garden Inn in Manhattan, Kansas. It starts at 8:30 in the morning and goes through 4 p.m. The live judging of the breads starts at 3. People have been submitting recipes and then being selected. There's been the process going on for a year or so now, and we have it down to 8 finalists. And so they're going to be there in their kitchens, so to speak, and making these recipes. There's also hands-on activities, free food samples, a fun kids zone, and, of course, the live baking competition with the 8 finalists. Grand prize is a KitchenAid stand mixer.
Ooh,
so that's a pretty nice prize there. So lots of things going on. If that's something that people are interested in, it's a great place to go.
Yeah, well, and for baking and breads either, I have no idea how it's made, but the proofing kind of, it kind of seems like an art form, something that takes patience, something that takes a lot of experience and time to do, not something that you could just hop in and pull together on the first day.
Right, to do it well. And these people in this contest have developed really interesting recipes using ingredients you wouldn't necessarily always think about. So it's just kind of fun, the flavor combinations and, you know, the things that they create. So it's really interesting.
Gotta love that. And again, you can listen to this podcast style on our main screen underneath the community tab if you'd like any more information on these, or just visit the K-State Research and Extension websites there.
That's right.
So, Jacob, let's talk a little bit more about complications around the garden, around the yard, and now we'll go ahead and open up the phone lines because I know there are some people out there that have got to be impacted, but some other complications that flooding could cause to the garden or surrounding area.
Okay, as far as flooding, probably there's not a whole lot of gardens yet I'm aware of.
Yeah.
I'm sure that happens. And again, if it's flooding, if it's just like Wendy said last week, is this ponding, water dish ponds on site, and you got water in the garden, but it hasn't come in from any other source, it's okay. It'll drain away. You just wash off the material because more than likely it's just local soil. When it comes in from a river or water that flows, maybe comes off parking lots and backs up into your yard and gets into the garden, you know, we got a little bit of an issue, and then that probably has some material in it that may be undesirable, and so those the produce probably should be destroyed. If it comes in from a river and there's potential for bacterial contamination, yeah, just forget it. Just destroy the entire garden and wait till the following year. It should decontaminate fairly well.
So with that, I hate to interrupt, but with that, you know, you say throw everything away in the garden at the time. Is the soil going to be contaminated as well for the following year? Or
well, if bacterial contamination, I'd like to see at least a period of about 9 months before you grow back in and grow produce. So that allows time for decontamination, that for the bacteria to die off, the undesirable bacteria and the regular soil bacteria to return to its normal situation. It allows time for decomposition of any type of organic debris that come in and are deposited within the garden itself. That's just a good thing to do. As far as, like I said, heavy metal contamination, if it occurs from floodwaters, it probably isn't a significant issue because of the tremendous volume of water and the tremendous amount of dilution of the material. It probably is not going to be an issue unless you're just right next to a place where that materials coming in and being deposited, and you may have a serious contamination issue because of the amount of lack of ability for dilution to occur. So that being said, I guess for me the number one issue is trying to keep that lawnmower running and get the lawn mowed in between rainstorms because well, I guess that's true of a lot of folks that have jobs. You hopefully get to the point where you can have time, and maybe in the evening or on the weekend, to get the job done. And of course, the rains are lined up. They happen on the weekends, and they also happen in the afternoons. So it kind of eliminates the ability to get that job done in a timely manner. So we'd like to get it done often enough so that we're not producing hay. So I got my front yard mowed yesterday afternoon. I got back and got the lawnmower going about 6 o'clock, and by the time I got the front yard done, it was the raindrops were falling, and I had to hurry up and get put away. So that's all I got done, and it should have been mowed about 5 days before, but it didn't get done.
Yeah, I know a lot of people out there, you know, aspiring entrepreneurs just trying to make an extra buck during the summertime. You know, man, their business is struggling right now, but I'll tell you what, here in about a week or two, or maybe even a little extended, you'll be busy, very, very busy with that grass growing. But so in terms of that, I know mowing your grass just kind of is healthier for it by any means, but what are the kind of the benefits of mowing your grass regularly?
Well, looking at grass plants, the way they grow and the type of grass that we have, if it's cool season grass, it's going to try to produce a seed stalk and flower and produce seed and then kind of go semi-dormant for the summer. But if you keep it mowed, you're encouraging leaf growth because grass leaves, they grow, they have kind of some meristematic tissue right at the base of the grass blade, and it continues to produce new grass blade from that point. So if you keep it clipped off, it's going to keep trying to replace that. It's going to keep growing it out. And mowed frequently enough, you're going to produce a turf. You're going to produce a nice carpet of grass. If you don't mow it frequently enough and you allow it to get fairly tall, it's already going to producing that that seed stock, and you end up with what's called stubble and a very unpleasing appearance of the lawn itself. It's going to be kind of a brownish color and dried up appearance, and it takes a bit of time for that grass to recover and produce new leaves that have been completely removed, clear to the beyond the point where that leaf collar is, where the new growth is occurring. So that produces a lot of stress on the plant, on the cool season grasses, and of course it's going to get dry sometime. I know it is going to happen, and we're going to wish we had some rain, but when that happens, it puts a lot of stress on those plants, and they in turn, maybe some of those dies, you get a thinning of the lawn. And so proper management of lawns is very important. And, of course, the lawnmower is probably one of the most important management tools of the lawn itself. So frequent mowing is very beneficial. Even no matter what kind of grass you have, it's very beneficial. Even crabgrass responds well to frequent mowing.
Okay. It's great exercise.
Okay. It is, yeah.
And it's
go
good.
Get your steps in, yeah exactly.
Right. Okay.
So. That's Jacob Weber alongside Barbara Ames with the K-State Research and Extension offices. Guys, thanks so much, and we'll check in with the K-State. next Wednesday.
All right, thank you.
Thank
this is the Mighty 690 KGGF.